They brought it into the black community because they made a connection there. And they had a built-in distribution system via the Crips and the Bloods. And so it was an easy market to make. There also wasn't a lot of police interference. And I found a piece that the AP had written a couple years ago that said right in the body of the article that CIA agents were involved in heroin trafficking during the Korean War. So it's been going on and on and on and on for years and years and years, and you're not allowed to talk about it. I mean, it's like one of our dirty secrets that everybody knows it goes on, but nobody's supposed to say anything about it.
You have just been listening to Gary Webb, a former San Jose Mercury News reporter who uncovered the CIA's role in protecting suppliers of cocaine into South Central Los Angeles, a pipeline that would go unchecked for years in African American communities and would eventually lead to the explosion of crack cocaine nationwide. I got a chance to talk to Gary about the long history of CIA involvement in drug trafficking, the role of drugs in U.S. foreign policy, and the reasons why, despite a 50-year history of involvement with drug trafficking, the American public knows little to nothing about it. Given the depth of the allegations that you were exploring with respect to the CIA's involvement in cocaine distribution, did you feel when you were involved with this story that somehow your life was ever at risk, or were there any threats to your personal safety that you were concerned about? I know that there were other journalists who had investigated these things where not so good things happened to them. I mean, did that ever cross your mind or affect you in any way?
Not while I was writing the story. I mean, I figured this stuff had happened so long ago that I was basically just a historian going back and documenting things that the statute of limitations had expired. It was not until after the series came out and there was this international uproar over it that I felt somewhat unsafe, especially when I had to go back down to Central America and do additional reporting for some stories that the Mercury News subsequently never published. The problem was, particularly with my Nicaraguan colleague George Hodel, I mean, he was subject to death threats. His wife had her law offices broken into, his house was burglarized, her brother was pistol whipped. So he was living with this very real danger. They don't do that kind of stuff here yet, but they were doing it to him, and he subsequently left and went to Switzerland.
The transactions that you describe in Dark Alliance covered transactions in Panama, Colombia, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, besides Nicaragua, obviously. And so this, in a sense, was truly an international operation. Given the scope of the transactions and the countries and different people involved, how isolated of an incident do you think that these transactions were?
Oh, I don't think they were isolated at all. As a matter of fact, I talk in my book about another contra drug pipeline that was operating at the same time on the East Coast, and that involved the Bahamas and Colombia and Nicaragua and Honduras, same thing. It was a different pipeline, but it was the same purpose. It was to supply the Contras with money. So I don't think this was isolated. Bob Parry, who's a great investigative reporter out of Washington, has written articles suggesting that these Contra drug rings were bringing in up to a third of the cocaine that was coming into this country during those years. So I think what I had written about was one part of a much larger operation.
Alexander Cockburn and Jeffrey St. Clair, in their book Whiteout, use your story as a launching pad to go into further investigations. And they point out and identify Mexico as being a key partner, and in particular the Salinas government, as also being involved in the significant trafficking of drugs, whether it's cocaine or marijuana. And how do those relationships fit into what you exposed in your work?
Well, it's all part of an overall pattern. After my stories came out in the Mercury News and there was that controversy, a writer named Charles Bowden interviewed me for Esquire. And he did a story that sort of wrapped my story in with the story of a DEA agent named Hector Bareilles, who was in charge of the Mexico City office. And Bareilles' fight to stop the CIA from helping Contra supporters transport drugs and actually grow marijuana in huge plantations then in Mexico. And Bareilles Gonzalez was convinced that that very famous case of Kiki Camarena, the DEA agent that was killed down there, was directly related to Camarena's involvement in investigating the CIA-connected drug farms. So you also had Terry Reed, who was another one who was involved with the Contra drug pipeline, and his story about the CIA shipping cocaine to the United States through his machine shop in Guadalajara. So Mexico played a very big role in this Contra drug ring. And the sad part is, after their job supplying the Contras was over with, these drug rings continued to operate, and no telling who that money went to after. You know, I stopped looking after the Contra War, but, you know, they still went on.
I guess that was one of the things that I was addressing, because I'm not sure that the dates of everything really necessarily even match up with the Contra activity. And I think that there's been a certain level of plausible deniability with respect to the importation of cocaine, because they can view it as an aberration specifically related to this Contra effort.
There was, again, Bob Perry broke this story, but when the CIA did its internal investigation after my series came out, there was a classified annex to that investigation, an investigative report, which the public never saw. Bob Perry interviewed somebody who saw part of it and wrote a story that said, after the Contra drug pipeline that I wrote about was taken down, another one started up in its place. And it was also being run by a former CIA agent who had worked on the Contra program, and this continued after the Contra War into the early 90s. So you're right. As I pointed out in my book, this drug ring pre-existed the Contras. It started in the late 70s, early 70s, actually, when they just started bringing cocaine into this country. So it was there. The CIA used it for convenience, and when they were done with it, it continued on its own.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with an author named William Blum, but he writes a book, Killing Hope. And in that book, he talks about Bolivia and the relationship of the United States government in all of the seemingly merry-go-round of dictators that had significant connections to drug growth and U.S. importation of such drugs. And just wondering, in your estimation, how Bolivia might have fit into this, because between Bolivia and Colombia, from what I understand, these are the two primary sources of all cocaine importation into the United States.
And then Peru is another big one. But what you're talking about is the so-called cocaine coup, which occurred in Bolivia in, I believe, 1980. Mike Levine, who is a former DEA agent, was involved in investigations of that, and he ended up writing a book about it, really coming down hard on the CIA because he knew that they were involved at the upper echelon of this cocaine coup. And what it did, basically, it put a government in power that was beholden to the cocaine industry. And Bolivia became a major producer of cocaine, a very protected producer of cocaine. And there were also connections between the Bolivian government and this Operation Condor that we've learned about in the last couple of years, and the Argentine government and the whole dirty war down there. The death squads, I'm convinced, were financed by drug money. So you enter into that world, starting with Bolivia in the early 80s, and you really enter into a parallel universe. I mean, a country run by drug traffickers for drug traffickers, and the money went and financed a lot of dirty operations all over the world.
Peter Del Scott and Noam Chomsky also point to a similar pattern of United States involvement in cocaine importation with respect to the fumigation activities under Plan Colombia. In Colombia, where the leftist movement, they're having their lands where coca leaves are grown, fumigated, while there are allegations that the right-wing government is a majority player in the exportation of cocaine out of Colombia. And I'm just wondering how you might think that this relationship of the United States to this Colombian government fits in as well.
Well, I think the way it fits in is the same way it fit in these other countries we went into under the guise of drug war. We're not really there to stamp out drugs. We're there to put down leftist uprisings. And I think Plan Colombia is just a cover for that. I mean, we give them military equipment, we give them helicopters, we give them training, and they're supposed to go out and stop drug traffickers. What they're doing is fighting a civil war, and we've taken sides. So I don't think there's any secret that once the United States decides that we need a regime change, we trump up various reasons for going in there. Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, cocaine in Colombia. It's pretty transparent, I think.
An interesting thing is there's another author, Alfred McCoy, and Peter Del Scott as well, who've written about the heroin boom in Asia. He points to Afghanistan, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Burma, as essentially having the similar type of plan where you have these bad guys, quote unquote, who are involved in the growth and exportation of heroin, but at the same time that they're quote unquote bad guys, they're our friends who are getting training, who are getting food drops, who are getting all these types of things. And so I'm wondering, when we think about drugs, whether they are heroin or cocaine or even to a lesser extent marijuana, should we expect that the CIA's involvement is the exception or rather the rule?
I think if you're talking about countries in which there is civil strife and which there is a desire on the part of the United States to change the government, I think you can automatically assume that drugs will be used as part of that war, either to help finance it, like they did in Central America, and to a, probably even a greater degree in Afghanistan in the late 70s when we started the war against the Mujahideen over there, or with the Mujahideen. I keep getting our friends confused with our enemies. Excuse me.
They change depending on the timing.
Yeah, that's right. And then, you know, look at now. I mean, Afghanistan is now back to being the world's leading heroin producer.
Ironically, it's now when they're our friends.
Right. And so I don't think it's too much of a leap to think that there might be a connection between an increase in drug production in a certain region and an increase in CIA covert military operations in that same region. It's happened all through history. And I found a piece that the AP had written a couple of years ago that said right in the body of the article that CIA agents were involved in heroin trafficking during the Korean War. So it's been going on and on and on and on for years and years and years, and you're not allowed to talk about it. I mean, it's like one of our dirty secrets that everybody knows it goes on, but nobody's supposed to say anything about it. Otherwise, you get accused of being a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, one of the amazing things in this book written by Alfred McCoy is that he talks about Lucky Luciano was let out of prison and sent to Italy, which is where he reestablished his booming heroin business with the total understanding of the United States government, not even its intelligence services, because at that time, it was much of a CIA. It was under a different name by Wild Bill Donovan, and it went on even then, and 30 years later.
Well, that was what was so surprising about the reaction to Dark Alliance, was people came out shrieking about how could we say such a thing about this agency when you look at its history, and I can't think of a time when it hasn't been involved with drug traffickers. I mean, it is the rule rather than the exception. I mean, maybe now they've wised up, but I doubt it.
How do you think that race plays a role in this? I mean, obviously, some of the people who are using these drugs, or at least some of the locale where these drugs were being sent to, were areas of economic decline that were predominantly, at least in the pipeline that you discussed, African-American communities, not even the Latino communities. And what do you think that the relationship is with race, or could this have happened to other communities, in your opinion?
I think it could have happened to other communities. I think the reason it happened to the African-American community, and I get into this in the book in greater detail, is because that's where they started it. Had they started bringing crack into Latino communities, I think it would have spread from Latino community to Latino community. They brought it into the Black community because they made a connection there, and they had a built-in distribution system via the Crips and the Bloods. And so it was an easy market to make. There also wasn't a lot of police interference with, I mean, South Central's been a drug market for many years. So when you look at it from the viewpoint of the Nicaraguans who were bringing this cocaine in and looking for a place to sell it, I think when they looked around, they saw South Central as an ideal marketplace because they weren't going to get in trouble by going down there and selling drugs. The connection they had made down there had very strong connections to the gangs, and the gangs could take the stuff out of the neighborhood and move it across the country. So I think race, to a degree, had that impact. I don't believe, and I've never really believed, that this was part of a quote-unquote genocidal campaign. I think it was an opportunity, I think it was a convenience, and I think they took advantage of it.
Just following up on that point, at some point there became the scourge of cocaine, and it seems like from reading your book that when the LA gang started going nationwide, that somehow put this thing on the radar. Do you think that is somewhat related to race?
I think that's totally related to race. I think at that point you had a lot of white Americans seeing stories and seeing things on the news about heavily armed Black men fanning out across the country. And at that point, I think you got caught up in a race hysteria, just like the sheriff's campaign in the 30s with cocaine, and it was sex crazed black men then, which is why we needed to outlaw this stuff. And I think you saw the same thing in the 80s. And I think that the imagery that was used was always young black men with Uzis and automatic weapons just to scare the bejesus out of God-fearing white people. And in that point, I think absolutely it was a race-related issue.
And very few people actually realize that some of the reasons why these young black men had Uzis and these advanced weapons were similarly related to government behavior.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's like that old song, one thing leads to another. You know, what happened in South Central was you had an influx of drugs, you had an influx of money, and you suddenly had an influx of weapons because these folks needed to protect their crack houses, they needed to protect their storehouses, they needed to protect their counting houses, and the Contras were in the gun business also. I mean, that's what they were using the drug money for, was to buy weapons. So what I found was a sort of a two-way street. Guns and ammo went in, drugs went in, money came out. And when you think about how in the world some kid on the corner of Figueroa gets his hands on an AK-47 or gets his hands on an AR-15, you just can't walk in and buy those off the rack at Kmart. I mean, somebody that knows something about weapons has to bring them in, and this drug ring knew a lot about weapons because they were buying weapons.
What do you think that the relationship of domestic policy is with respect in particular to the criminal justice system and what some would argue institutionalized racism and our foreign policy?
I think there's a huge disconnect is what I think the problem is. What I pointed out in my book was that this was a case of blowback of monumental proportions, and that nobody really gave a damn or gave a thought to what happens when these drugs hit the streets of the United States. What they were thinking about was raising money for the Contras to use in this war against communism in Central America. And, you know, if people bought these drugs, well, that was their own fault. So I don't think anybody gave a great deal of thought to it, which is the problem. You can't expect to allow people to bring tons of cocaine into your neighborhoods and not expect that there's going to be some sort of result from that, and some sort of bad result from that. And the fact that it happened in African-American neighborhoods primarily, I think, was a good excuse for a lot of people to toughen up the drug laws and throw yet a lot of black people in prison.
At the same time, in your book, you also mentioned that some of the forces behind, some of the Nicaraguans themselves, did not really suffer heavy prosecution.
No, the kingpin of this organization never spent a day in prison in the United States. I found FBI records and DEA records going back to the 70s, which clearly showed the government knew what he was doing. He was never prosecuted. He was indicted. The indictment was sealed and filed away. He later went to work for the DEA. His number two man, Blandón, worked for the DEA. After he got out of prison, he did 24 months for a lifetime of cocaine trafficking, which you can get that much for a burglary charge. And he got out and went on the DEA payroll. And the only guy that spent any significant time in prison was a third man on the totem pole, Freeway Ricky Ross, who just coincidentally happened to be African-American. So the two Nicaraguans got off pretty much scot-free, and the African-American went to jail for life.
Without parole. And we're talking about Meneses, who's the first person that you mentioned.
Right, Norman Meneses, who is now out of jail down in Nicaragua and back in the drug business.
There was a great deal of excitement and concern in the African-American community about these stories. Do you think that the fervor has died down since then? And if so, why?
Well, I think there was a concerted effort on the part of the establishment media primarily, but also on the part of the government to put this down. I think when people in Washington became really concerned about this was when the black community became activists, when they went and marched on Capitol Hill, when they went into these hearings and shouted down these senators and demanded a real investigation. That's when the counterattack started in the quote-unquote establishment media, the New York Times, the LA Times. And I'm not naive enough to think that there wasn't a reason for this, which was we don't want the black population up in arms about this. We don't want a real investigation into this. We want people to think this is bullshit. We want this to go away. And with the cooperation of media, that's what happened. I think Maxine Waters had a very hard time finding help in Washington to do this. And I believe Maxine was sincere. She really wanted to get to the bottom of this and probably still does. But, you know, this whole topic has taken on such an aura of wacko conspiracy theory that nobody wants to touch it anymore.
So that was actually leading into my next question, was just about what we've talked about already in terms of United States involvement with importation of cocaine from Bolivia, United States involvement of cocaine with Colombia, with Nicaragua, with Panama, with El Salvador, with Honduras. with Mexico, with Afghanistan, with Vietnam, with Laos, with Cambodia, and there's still seemingly a huge disconnect on the part of the American public, despite books being published, despite your book being published about the CIA's involvement in anything. How do you think that the media can be so effective in shutting down this knowledge, which you can get some access to in a local public library?
I think because they don't want to do this story. It doesn't say very good things about this country. You know, it exposes a hypocrisy that I think most people would rather not know about. I mean, we're still spending billions of dollars a year on this phony drug war, when at the same time, I mean, like you said, there are books in libraries that are full of evidence that the United States government has been complicit in the drug trade. And I think it's one of these things that the truth is just too ugly for people to want to look at. And I think the media is no different. I don't think they like this kind of story. You're talking about crimes of state, essentially. And the media in this country has gotten progressively more cowardly over the past few years than brave. And this is a story that takes guts to do and to hold people accountable for. And when you're talking about, in my case, the Reagan-Bush administration, you're talking about the people that are back in government and running the country for right now. So who's going to go after them?
Yeah, and that's leading once again to another question is, in your opinion, what is the possibility or what are the conditions precedent for this to somehow change?
I think one of the things that you're going to have to do is get a progressive majority in Congress that's not afraid to expose America, this very dark chapter of American history, for what it was, and hope we can learn something from it. But the Democrats and the Republicans, they don't want this kind of stuff. It's messy, it's ugly, it gets people indicted, it gets people who have buildings and ships named after them tarnished. It's just a bad deal for both parties. So I think it's one of these things that's just going to be left to the judgment of history. And when there's enough time elapsed between these crimes and the people who committed them are all dead, I think that's when we might take a good hard look at what we did point. When you're talking about the United States government involved in selling drugs, we're not talking that long ago. And we're talking about, I think, something that's far worse than what happened during McCarthy, because the effects of it are enormous. The liabilities are enormous. So it's going to take some distance before we get to that point, if we ever do.
With respect to the drug business, and I'm not sure that you can really answer that, but if you can, I would invite you. How far up the food chain do you think that the knowledge went with respect to what has been going on in terms of the connection between the drug cocaine business? Because there's always the notion of plausible deniability that is very important for the mythology of Americans to think that their government is doing good things and that when bad things happen, it is by mistake.
Well, I think all you have to do in this case, one of the most important documents we found was this memorandum of understanding between the Justice Department and the CIA that was written in, I believe, late 1980, early 1981, in which they said, in essence, if the CIA agent or a CIA asset is believed to be trafficking narcotics, the Justice Department does not have to be told about it. Now, this was signed by the head of the CIA and the head of the Justice Department, and the only possible reason for that is because they knew that the Contras, they knew that the Mujahideen were going to be involved in drug trafficking. So it went right to the top. I mean, nobody has ever come up with a satisfactory explanation for why this document was needed. I mean, Maxine Waters discovered it during the course of her congressional investigation, and there was this thundering silence from Washington as to why we needed a loophole for CIA drug trafficking. That, to me, like Bob Perry pointed out, is the strongest evidence yet that we've seen of premeditation. They knew this was going to happen. They knew people were going to get caught. They needed plausible deniability, so we needed this loophole. And I challenge anyone to produce a rational explanation for this criminal document.
And it's important to note, obviously enough, that the father of the current president, who was a former president himself, was the head of the CIA at one point. Obviously, he might not have been at the time of that document, but at the same time, drug connections have been a mainstay of American foreign policy for a number of years.
Well, that plus the fact that Bush was very heavily involved with the Contra operation, and Bush's office was very heavily involved with the Contra operation. There's no question about that, despite the lies of the campaign where he said he was out of the loop, he didn't know this, that, and the other thing. The CIA, one of the things that came out in the CIA's report was that they had prepared an extensive, very detailed briefing for then Vice President Bush on all the instances of Contra involvement in cocaine trafficking. So he knew all about it. I mean, the CIA told him about it.